This is the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we talk about the big political stories of the week. Mike Siluma, and thank you for joining us. Recently, our constitution has been the subject of much debate following a critical opinion piece penned by the tourism minister, Lindiwe Sisulu. So, in this episode of the Politics Weekly, we thought we should invite one of the leaders who participated in the drafting and adoption of the Constitution, struggle veteran, activist, and former Constitutional Development Minister, Mohamed Vali Musa.
This aircon is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
Sergeant at arms, can you please come in?
Hey, welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly.
Thank you very much.
A lot of people know you in your adult days as a minister of constitutional development or minister of environment, or in your current incarnation, you know, being an activist in the environment, in areas of climate change, etc. But your background, you know, how did you end up in this sphere, in politics, if you like?
Oh, well, I don't know whether there's time to go through the whole story, but just to say very briefly, Mike, I was part of the generation that was inspired by the 1976 uprisings, and the years before that by the Black Consciousness Movement. That was a time when young people, particularly students, were taking a stand against apartheid and took upon themselves the attitude that nobody else is going to liberate you, that you have to liberate yourself, and that it is better to die on your feet than to live your life on your knees in dignity. So that's really what inspired us. And, you know, apartheid was all around us. Nobody could not be affected by it. And so, you know, I studied, I had to go to, although I was living in Johannesburg, I had to go to study at the University of Durban-Westville because they didn't allow Indians any other university. I graduated in pure mathematics. And after that, I decided to become a full-time political activist. Throughout the 80s, I didn't do anything other than participate in the struggle, and that was what I did, and of course joined the ANC in the struggle, became a leader of the United Democratic Front. I was in the Mass Democratic Movement, and when the ANC was unbanned and other political parties were unbanned in 1990, I got involved in the settlement talks, the negotiations, and ultimately in the drafting of the South African Constitution.
How did you end up being drafted into those negotiations?
Well, you know, when the political prisoners were first being released, even before the unbanning of the ANC, I had been very closely with the late Walter Sisulu. And at the time when the ANC got unbanned, Walter Sisulu had the responsibility of establishing what was called the Internal Leadership Corps and establishing the ANC as a political party. And because of my involvement in the United Democratic Front and the Mass Democratic Movement, he drew me in as part of his team. When the first conference of the ANC was held after the unbanning in Durban in 1990, I was elected onto the National Executive Committee and onto the National Working Committee. And then I was given the responsibility. My portfolio was the constitutional negotiations. And so from 1990 to 1994, I worked full time on the constitutional negotiations. And then after that, President Mandela appointed me in the cabinet as Minister for Constitutional Development. And then in the second term of democracy, President Mbeki appointed me as Minister for Environment. And after 10 years in Parliament, I decided to not make myself available for another term, because I thought 10 years in Parliament was sufficient.
Let's go back to the constitutional negotiations themselves. What led to them? Because I suspect it would not just have been out, you know, as a, you know, as a matter of spontaneous combustion, you know, that people come together and then they decide, ah, no, because we like each other, let's have a conversation about the future of the country.
Yes, what happens in any situation of conflict, in any struggle, or for that matter, in any war, a point is reached normally where the parties, where one of the parties gains the upper hand and the other party loses. And then they come to the table to talk about the terms of the settlement. In another way of looking at it was that the apartheid regime decided to come to the table to negotiate the terms of their surrender, because actually they were surrendering white minority rule. They were surrendering the apartheid ideology. And what were the terms of discussing that? So that was the one element of the negotiations. The other element of the negotiations involved the drafting of the new South African constitution. And at the time, the South African parliament was the apartheid parliament. It was an undemocratic institution, unrepresentative of the people of South Africa. It was only voted in by a minority. And so we needed to discuss the methodology for the drafting and adopting of a new South African democratic constitution. You could not have an undemocratic parliament or an undemocratic apartheid government adopting a democratic constitution. It would be a contradiction in terms. So the negotiations are about, how do we organize democratic elections that are free and fair? How do we choose a constitutional assembly, a group of elected women and men who will then have the mandate from the voters to draft and adopt a new constitution? So a lot of the negotiations were about that. How do you actually do that? And so that took up the bulk of the negotiations. The actual final constitution was then drafted in post-April 1994, 1995, and 1996. And it was finally adopted by the Constitutional Assembly in October 1996 by the Constitutional Assembly, which had a democratic mandate from the voters to do so.
Just briefly, who were the contending parties in those negotiations? I mean, did you have a round table? Did you have a square table? Did you?
Yeah. When we were deciding in the early 90s on starting the negotiations, there were a number of matters that needed to be cleared up. One was what we referred to as preconditions for the negotiations. All political prisoners should be released. We couldn't have been negotiating when a number of our leaders and political prisoners were still imprisoned, that the state of emergency had to be lifted, you know, and such things. There were a number of preconditions to make it possible for all parties. And from our side, we were, of course, also concerned about the ANC, that the ANC must be able to operate freely, must be able to consult with the masses freely. And we didn't want the negotiations to be conducted in a manner where there would be suspicion about what is being discussed. So we wanted openness. And that is why the negotiations, both CODESA 1, CODESA 2, the multi-party negotiations, were conducted in the open. I don't know if you recall, Mike, that those negotiations were open to any observer. Anybody could come there, any journalist, in fact, any member of the public could come into the room, sit and listen to what was being discussed by the negotiators. The apartheid regime, in an attempt to isolate the liberation movement and the ANC in particular, said that all political parties must have an equal say at the negotiating table. So they wanted all of the political parties from the Bantustans to be at the negotiating table. And of course, we had thought that that didn't make any sense as such. The negotiation should be on the one side, the liberation movement represented by the ANC, and on the other side, it should be the apartheid regime. So in the end, we ended up having about 20 or so political parties around the table, all the Bantustan parties, those that were collaborating with the regime, the parties from the tricameral parliament. But in essence, the actual negotiations took place between the ANC and the apartheid regime, and the rest of them understood it as such. So you had those who were on the side of the regime and those who were on the side of the ANC, and then you had, in reality, it became a two-sided table between the apartheid regime, because you couldn't talk settlement with a party in the tricameral parliament that didn't have any power at all. What did we need them to settle for? For what? You know? So it didn't happen in that way.
And so the negotiations begin. What would you say were the most intractable issues, you know, that preoccupied the negotiators?
At the end of the negotiations, Mike, was about the ending of apartheid, the destruction of apartheid, the dismantling of apartheid on the one side, and in its place, establishing one person, one rule in a united, democratic, non-racial South Africa. That was the core, what we were trying to achieve. And when you say one person, one vote, of equal value, we were actually talking about majority rule. There should be nothing less than majority rule. In a democratic system, whatever the majority of the voters want should be the decision at the end of the day. So that was one of the most difficult things that we had, because the apartheid regime and the white minority wanted to have some kind of protection for the white minority. They didn't want there to be a situation that whites and blacks, the votes of whites and blacks would be counted in an equal manner. I mean, everybody's votes would be equal. They said, what would happen to us? You know, we have insecurities, you know, blacks are going to take all our things, et cetera, et cetera. So we must have minority protection. And they wanted all sorts of things in order to have minority protection. And that was one of the most intractable things that you had. The other big thing from the side of the liberation movement was that we wanted to replace the apartheid system with a new democratic system in which never again would it be possible for minority rule to emerge. Never again can you possibly have a situation where you have fascism and where you have the majority of South Africans being denied the law, that the law is not for them, the law is only for white people. You're never ever going to want to have that kind of thing. So that was a very important thing, that our constitution must entrench a freedom for all forever. It was a very big thing. Now, under apartheid, for example, you had a situation where human rights didn't apply to everybody. So whites had the right to move around wherever they want to. Blacks didn't have a right to move around freely. Or, for example, when you talk about the issue of property, that black people did not have the right to own property. And if black people did own property, the law did not apply to them. The government could come and take the property away without even giving notice, without a hearing, without going to court, without compensation or anything of that sort. And you had, in the 80s and the 70s, we witnessed large-scale forced removals of people, where black people were just rounded up in the middle of the night, loaded up in trucks, and removed from the land which belonged to them and dumped into Bantustans. And so we were saying, never again should you have a situation where somebody's things can just be taken away from them, without anything, without any kind of rule of law applying to them. So those were some of the things. And then, of course, the Bill of Rights was important. That apartheid was all about a denial of human rights. So freedom should be about an entrenchment of human rights. And so the Bill of Rights was an important element of our constitution. That is why it is highly protected. It's not easy to change the Bill of Rights because these are rights since the invasion of South Africa by the colonialists over 300 years ago, and rights were denied. And now those rights must be entrenched. So the Bill of Rights was actually very, very, very important for us that it should not allow discrimination on any basis whatsoever. And then the other thing that we wanted the Constitution to be adapted to the realities of South Africa, because we were not drawing up a constitution for Canada or for Australia or for Egypt. We were drawing up a constitution for South Africa. And in South Africa, we needed transformation. We needed to redress the wrongs of the past. And therefore, the constitution should not stand in the way of things, for example, like employment equity, affirmative action. In fact, the constitution should require everybody to promote equality. And to ensure that, for example, when it comes to public institutions, that they are representative broadly of the demographies in South Africa. Then the constitution must also enable the promotion and the advancement of women. Because the people who were most oppressed under apartheid were the women. And so the constitution said special measures must be taken. Even if it looks undemocratic, but special measures are needed to ensure that women can advance. And, at the time, Mike, when you and I were young, you didn't know of an African woman chartered accountant. I don't know if you knew of any, there was no such thing, so you needed special measures to ensure that that because women were so oppressed in the past, that the advancement of women is encouraged.
Mm. Now, earlier on, you characterized the negotiations or the separation or division at the negotiating table between the liberation movement and the apartheid government, and you said the apartheid government was negotiating a surrender, essentially, of the ideology and of power, in the country. Now, if you look at the criticism that is leveled at the constitution nowadays, people are saying that this was a compromise. That's why they feel that the constitution is not delivering what the majority of people had expected it to. What is your view to that?
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about the question of compromise. But before I say that, I've been reading quite a lot about whether recently in the media, about whether the Constitution has delivered, whether it has lived up to its expectations, that many people's lives have not changed. We still have a huge inequality in this country between the rich and the poor. And for many people, they still don't have houses, et cetera, et cetera. And we have such a large proportion of unemployed youth in this country, which is a shame. Now, I think that it is in a sense an easy way out to say it is the constitution that has not delivered. We voted for government after government, every 5 years since 1994. We pay those government taxes. And we expect the governments and the public service to do the delivery. That's where the delivery happens. The Constitution enables them to do that sort of thing. And so I think you should not we should be careful about saying it's a constitution that has not created jobs, because constitution is really there to say these are the rules. They're not there to actually manage society any more than that is concerned. On the question of compromise, yes, there is one compromise which we had made, and that was the compromise to create a government of national unity. We were finding in the 90s that the regime was beginning to crumble, and you ran the risk of everything becoming completely chaotic, because the National Party itself as a political party was imploding, and white minority rule was imploding and falling apart. So you needed to, we reached a point where we thought if we don't speed up the first democratic elections, we may end up with just utter chaos. And in order to speed it up, the only way to do it was to create what was called a government of national unity. And that government of national unity, what it said is that, okay, the party that wins the elections can form the government. But in the cabinet, even a party that has lost the elections, the second biggest party, it should be given some seats in the cabinet, and it should be given a second, there should be two deputy presidents, it should be given a second deputy president. That's how de Klerk in 1994 became the second deputy president, and a few National Party members became members of cabinet. That was, we didn't want that, but that was a compromise that was made. It lasted from 1994 to 1996. It was not a compromise that affected the Constitutional Assembly, because the Constitutional Assembly was a sovereign body. It worked outside of cabinet. It worked on its own. We drafted the Constitution in the Constitutional Assembly, not with the permission of cabinet at all, because those 400 members were elected directly by the public to write the Constitution. And it ended the National Party in government. The government of national unity ended in 1996. There is no permanent compromise in the constitution at all. In fact, it is one of the most revolutionary constitutions you can find, especially if you take the trouble to read the Bill of Rights very carefully. You will find the deep transformative nature of the constitution.
Okay, just one last point before we run out of time. Every time people are unhappy, you know, they will tend to say, let's amend the constitution. Let's amend section whatever of the constitution. Is it a good thing or a bad thing to want to amend the constitution when we are unhappy?
Look, amending the constitution is not necessarily an evil thing, and it's not necessarily a sin. Let's get that out of the way, because all constitutions need updating, you know, as time goes on. And you may have thought that the constitution, a certain provision of the constitution, will work out in a certain way, but society changes and the interests of society changes, then you change. So that there's nothing wrong with doing that. But whenever there's a failure of the administration, when government doesn't do its job and ministers don't do their work, you can't then blame it on the constitution. I mean, how many ministers and government departments have the money? You know, our national budget is almost 2 trillion rands. We as the public give the government 2 trillion rands to do all the work that needs to be done. That's a lot of money. And many government departments don't use that money in an efficient way. So you can't now say you're going to change the constitution, because changing the constitution will not solve that problem. You must solve the problem where it is. In fact, it could make the problem even worse as such. There is nothing in the constitution that prevents government from doing the things that needs to be done to improve the lives of people in this country. Absolutely nothing.
Well, folks, that's where we wrap it up here on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly for this week. And we'd like to thank our guest for this week, longstanding anti-apartheid activist and former Minister of Constitutional Development in the Nelson Mandela administration, Mohamed Vali Musa. We appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, for a podcast of this conversation, you can go to Iono FM, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or wherever you prefer to source your podcasts. Until next time, do remember to stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Siluma, signing off.